Hello and welcome to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. As always, we're glad to have you here at the podcast. This week, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Baggett about C.S. Lewis's moral argument. As you might know, Dr. Baggett is the executive editor of moralapologetics.com. He's also the co-author of Good God, along with Dr. Jerry Walls. Dr. Walls and Dr. Baggett have a sequel to Good God coming out next year called God and Cosmos, and they critique secular ethical theories in that book. Dr. Baggett just recently led a PhD seminar on C.S. Lewis, which I got to take that as a student. It was a really great experience. We spent all week discussing several different of C.S. Lewis's works. We read most of his non-fiction works. And I just encourage you, if you're out there and you're thinking about doing PhD work in apologetics, check out Liberty's program. We have access to some really great professors, including Dr. Baggett, who teaches moral apologetics. But with that in mind, we're going to go ahead and get right over to Dr. Baggett's office here in Lynchburg, Virginia, and hear his comments on C.S. Lewis's moral argument. So, Dr. Baggett, do you have any kind of initial thoughts on Lewis and morality that you can get going with?
Well, sure. You know, C.S. Lewis is well known for giving a version of the moral argument that's just about the most popular version out there. The whole of Book One of Mere Christianity is devoted to it. And so he's really the guy who popularized the moral argument in the 20th century. And so I suppose that might be a good place to start.
Yeah, well, maybe you can just say briefly what his moral argument is, and maybe how it's different than your own argument that you develop in Good God.
Sure. Lewis's argument begins with two central sort of premises or theses, you know, both of which he thinks are fairly obvious. And it's on this foundation that he gradually constructs the argument he puts together there. But one of the premises is that there is a moral standard, that there's an objective moral guideline to which we're accountable, all of us as human beings, and our very language, moral language, shows that we really tend to believe in this standard. It's an objective standard that applies to us all. And he says, you know, imagine hearing two people quarrel about something. It's rare that you'd hear someone say, well, I don't believe in any kind of standard, you know. Instead, it's about, well, you know, you violated the standard. No, I didn't. I don't deny that the standard is there, but what I did is consistent with the standard and this sort of thing. So he says, look, if you just listen very carefully to the language that we use in our quarreling and such, This gives us a really good reason to believe that there is this objective moral standard. So that's the first premise. Then the second is that it's a standard that we all inevitably fall short of. None of us live up to the standard, right? Inevitably, at one time or another, we fall short. And so, like he says, these two central ideas really function effectively as an insight into reality, that there's an objective moral standard and we fall short of it. And we have to come to terms with what that might imply about ultimate reality.
Okay, yeah, that sounds very, kind of similar to at least the first premise, to what Robert Adams argues in Finite and Infinite Goods about how moral language suggests that there has to be this sort of the good that makes it work. Can you maybe, what do you think? What do you think about similarity? Maybe you can say a little about what Adams' view is. Do you think Adams' view is influenced by Lewis's at all? Or?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that one. I suppose possibly, although I, for some reason, tend to doubt it. But I'm not really sure. You know, I mean, because Robert Adams is just a premier analytic philosopher, and yeah, in his book Finite and Infinite Goods, does do something similar, right? He looks at the way that our language is used, and then he tries to identify what would fill the role of the good, right. You know, based upon the way in which we use our language. And ultimately, he argues that what would really best fill that role of the good is God himself. And that, of course, is very much Lewis's view as well, that nothing less than God himself is the ultimate good. And there's a long history of this kind of theistic Platonic view, you know, in the history of the church, among Christian philosophers and theologians and the like. I forgot you had asked me how does Lewis's argument compare to ours?
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, the way Lewis emphasizes the performative dimension, in that there's the standard that we fall short of, and ultimately he's going to say things that echo or that are similar to the words of, say, John Hare, mm-hmm. contemporary John Hare, that we need God's grace to fill that gap between where we are and where God wants us to be. In that sense, there's a performative element or dimension mm-hmm. to Lewis's moral argument. The argument that Jerry Wallace and I are putting forth in the sequel to Good God, especially, will be a fourfold moral argument, okay. And one of the four dimensions will be that performative component. So in that sense, we could agree with everything that Lewis does, and kind of dovetail that into this larger treatment that we're giving, because we're going to be constructing sort of a cumulative, you know, multi-pronged moral argument for God's existence. But yeah, it's very much in the spirit of Lewis and in the spirit of others as well.
Yeah, so one of the questions that I have about this too is whether you think whether you see Lewis's argument as abductive or deductive, and maybe you can just say quickly what the abductive means.
Sure.
Too.
Yeah. Well, deductive and abductive. We'll just quickly review what both mean. A deductive argument is an argument in which the premises logically guarantee the conclusion, or at least this is its aim. So, you know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, right? So the paradigmatic example of a deductive argument. An abductive argument is non-deductive. Some might just say it's kind of inductive. Others distinguish abduction from induction. I'm inclined to do that as well. It goes back to guys like Peirce and Harman and others, and it's a form of reasoning that you find in science and intelligent artificial intelligence, in history, in all kinds of areas. But it's basically an inference to the best explanation. Abduction is an inference to the best explanation, where you start out with facts in need of explanation, you construct a pool of explanation candidates, you use a principled set of criteria to narrow down the explanation candidates to the one that you deem the best explanation of the phenomena in question, and then you at least tentatively infer to it as the likely true explanation. Plantinga does express a reservation about abduction in this way, because he says, suppose that the best explanation is still statistically very unlikely, or something like that. And that is a potential problem. So you'd better hope that your best explanation is at least plausible enough to warrant inferring to it as the likely true explanation. But presumably that's not going to be an issue here. So is Lewis's argument deductive or abductive? Yeah, it could be cashed out in either way. I think John Beversluis, in his commentary on Lewis, tended to put Lewis's arguments in the form of deduction, but then quickly proceeded to knock the arguments down, having done so. But that's largely because I suspect that hammering Lewis's arguments into deductive format makes them rather susceptible to criticism. And in that sense, I think doing so isn't the most charitable way to do it. Right. I suspect the more charitable treatment of Lewis's arguments, including his moral argument, is to treat it as something like an abductive inference to the best explanation. something like that. Because once you narrow down the potential explanations to naturalistic ones and a theistic one or a supernaturalistic one, Lewis makes the case that supernaturalism is just better at accounting for the distinctive features of morality, like its binding, prescriptive authority, and the like. And that can take some time to lay out in detail. We've done that kind of thing before, but that's the sort of thing that he's going after. The idea would be that suppose you just have two explanation candidates, some kind of theistic ethic and some kind of naturalistic ethic, right? Mm-hmm. And again, I'm speaking in broad generalities here, obviously. But if the theistic option provides the better explanation, right, provides the more compelling explanation of a wider range of what needs to be explained, that kind of thing, and it's not so ad hoc and it accords with our other beliefs, other things that we know and the like, then we have good reason to infer to it as the likely true explanation. Yeah, that's the idea. So I suspect that that's probably the best way to interpret Lewis's moral argument.
Okay, so the advantage of abductive reasoning then is, number one, over deductive, is that if you form a deductive argument, then you only have to raise possibilities that it's not true to undermine the argument. So I'm trying to think of an example. Like if you said, oh gosh, hard to think of an example, because I was going to say, the one is like all bachelors are single men.
You could use the deductive version of the problem of evil, right?
Right.
That says there's evil and there's God. They can't possibly coexist. So therefore, in the face of the evil that we find, God doesn't exist, right?
Right.
But then Plantinga comes along, with his defense, and he posits at least a possible story for the existence of a certain amount of evil. And the mere positing of the possibility is enough to undo the alleged airtight certainty of the deductive argument. So the possibility, does away with the deductive version.
Okay, so yeah, that's helpful. So that's what Beverloos just has to, when you cash it out in deductive terms, in order to defeat the argument, you just have to raise some, coherent possible scenario that defeats the argument, mm-hmm. right? But if you're doing it abductively, then the argument, while the conclusion is not airtight, it nevertheless makes the argument much harder to defeat, because one of the reasons is because the conclusion is more modest in itself. It's saying, well, the best explanation instead of, therefore,
yeah.
Certainly this is
right.
the conclusion.
The only possible explanation. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And another difference, interestingly, is suppose you have a deductive argument with two premises and a conclusion. You might think that your conclusion is going to be likely true if you can show each premise individually to be more likely true than false. Tim McGrew has actually given a counterexample to that kind of idea, because he says, imagine that you have a dice, right, and you roll it. So it's got 1 through 6. And when you roll it, it's going to be, say, 1, 2, 3, or 4. Well, yeah, that likely will be either 1, 2, 3, or 4. So that's premise one. Premise two, that one time when you roll it, it's going to be more likely true than false that it'll be 3, 4, 5, or 6, mm-hmm. right? Oh, there you have it. So you got two premises, each more likely true than false. But what deductively follows from those two premises actually is that the roll is going to yield either a 3 or 4, right? That mm-hmm. follows deductively yeah. from the premises, but it's not more likely true than false. And so the take home from that, as Tim shows, is that it's the premise set that needs to be more likely true than false. And that is going to be harder to show than merely that each premise is more likely true than false. And so that kind of ups the ante for the proponent of the deductive argument, the deductive moral argument. The case is going to have to be made that the premise set itself, taken as a whole, is more likely true than false.
Okay, great. Well, I think that gives us kind of an idea of what Lewis was saying with his moral argument in Mere Christianity. How do you think his argument, how successful is it? How do you think it's been viewed by other professional philosophers? What's the impact that it's had, would you say?
Yeah, well, I think it's been very effective at a popular level in getting people to think about the moral argument. Of course, Mere Christianity was originally a series of radio broadcasts during the war. And so, you know, people were very mindful that bad things were happening. Some really horrific and atrocious, abominable things were taking place. And, you know, I don't think they had any doubt about that. And you might think, boy, that's going to really make something like the problem of evil poignant and practically insuperable. But no, to the contrary, people at those moments, I think, often are looking for explanations for, you know, the reality of good and evil, the distinction between good and evil and right and wrong and hope in the face of suffering and such. And his radio message found a very receptive audience. You know, people ate this kind of thing up. So here he was giving a philosophical argument. He was essentially doing moral apologetics during a war, and it became something wildly popular. And even since publication, too, you know, its reputation has only grown at the popular level. I think that professional philosophers tend to look a bit askance at some of what Lewis does because they think, well, you know, he wasn't really a philosopher. Maybe he was more of a literature guy and that kind of thing. But he really did have a very adroit philosophical mind. And the first course that he taught at Oxford was in philosophy. His professor was going away for a year and needed someone to replace him and asked Lewis to do it. And he was very gifted, a very analytic mind, a very philosophically gifted individual. That's why we did our book, you know, C.S. Lewis as a Philosopher, Gary Habermas, Jerry Walls, and I some years ago. So I think that his philosophical instincts were good. I think that the argument has a tremendous amount of potential. I do think, though, that it was written of necessity at a bit of a general level, and so all kinds of details need to be filled in. But I think that can be done, just like Victor Reppert did with Lewis's argument from Reason, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, or others have done with his argument from Desire and the like. So, you know, much of the work that we do as moral apologists today is take something like the structure that Lewis provides, and we try to fill in some of those details, you know, close some of those gaps, answer some of the objections, flesh things out as they need to be.
And so you did this in an essay with Dr. Eric Wielenberg.
Right.
You defended a version of Lewis's moral argument. And what's the name of that book? When is it coming out?
Yes. That book is called C.S. Lewis's Christian Apologetics. C.S. Lewis's Christian Apologetics. I think it's available now.
Okay.
Pro and Con, edited by Greg Basham. And yeah, this is a good book. It's something that y'all ought to take a look at if you're interested. It covers five topics. Lewis's argument from desire, his argument from reason, the moral argument, the trilemma, mm-hmm. you know, Lord, liar, lunatic, kind of, and then the problem of evil. And in each case, you have pro and con. So argument from desire, you got Peter Williams and Greg Basham kind of going head to head, you know, and there's a pro piece, a con piece, and then a pro and then a con. So likewise, the argument from reason features Victor Reppert and David Kyle Johnson. Eric Wielenberg, as you say, and I handled the moral argument. Donald Williams and Adam Barkman, the trilemma, and Phil Tallon and David O'Hara, the problem of evil. But yeah, Eric and I went back and forth on that one, and he raised some, you know, some potent and trenchant objections, and I tried to answer them, and he offered a rejoinder. Yeah, Eric's a delightful fellow and a really good philosopher, and that was a lot of fun. But yeah, this is the ongoing discussion, you know, and that was a very ironic and enjoyable exchange of ideas there. And that's the sort of thing that this website's devoted to encouraging.
Yeah, well, maybe could you say maybe one or two things with what you did with Lewis's argument, where you maybe felt you needed to expand it or buttress it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of the three tasks for the moral apologist, the task of defending moral realism and then critiquing secular ethical attempts to account for moral realism, and arguing in favor of some sort of theistic ethic as the superior explanation. In terms of, you know, those three things, what Lewis did, you know, could be questioned at each juncture. I think he has very suggestive things to say about all three. But again, of necessity, his treatment was, you know, kind of quick. So defending moral realism, I mean, there are additional objections, especially nowadays, that have been raised against that kind of thing. And so we have to figure out what we would say to the moral skeptics, mm-hmm. the moral anti-realists and the like. And Jerry Walls and I are intending to write a whole book on that subject down the line because, you know, we've come to see that that is an issue probably that we'll see more and more of. In terms of taking on naturalistic ethics, I suspect that someone could, with some legitimacy, argue that what Lewis did was a little too quick. He gave some general criticisms of naturalistic ethics, but he didn't spend as much time looking at specific secular naturalistic ethical theories as he, you know, he could have or should have or whatever. I'm not sure he should have in that context, but surely moral apologetics needs to do that and needs to take that job seriously. That's why our book, God and Cosmos, is coming out in February, does that. Mm-hmm. We attempt to really look at a broad array of naturalistic and secular ethical theories along these four dimensions of the moral argument, you know, moral facts, moral knowledge, moral transformation, and the consistency between happiness and holiness, and argue that in each case, theism provides the superior explanation. And then in terms of making that case, of course, you have to defend theistic ethics against objections and give additional positive reasons in its favor. And Lewis did a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. But of course, quite a bit more work could have been done and needs to be done by the moral apologetics community. So I see not in principle problems with Lewis's argument. Of course, Eric would disagree with me on that.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm inclined to see the argument as having a great deal of potential. Yes, it needs to be fleshed out at points, but yeah, it's got a lot going for it, and I think that very good contemporary professional philosophers and the like can flesh out the argument in the way it needs to be.
Okay, well, let me ask you this: there's different versions of theistic ethics that one might want to defend. Or whether it's some sort of virtue ethic or natural law theory or divine command theory or divine motivation theory, like Linda Zagzagsby defends. What do you think is, do you think Lewis is defending or suggesting particular ethical theory, theistic ethical theory in Christianity, or do you think it's compatible with different ones?
Yeah, much of what he has to say, I think, is compatible with various ones. Virtue theory, I don't really see that as quite on a par with some of these other ones. I certainly think you could be a virtue theorist and a divine command theorist at the same time. You know, C. Stephen Evans makes that case effectively. We kind of hinted at that sort of thing in Good God, and others have as well. Robert Adams is a divine command theorist and wrote a whole book on moral mm-hmm. virtue, too. You know, I mean, the emphasis on virtue is very much going to be that emphasis on transformation of not just what we do, but who we are, the people that we are becoming, the trajectory that we're on based upon the decisions that we make and all of that. And according to, say, you know, classical Christianity, God's grace is available for us to experience radical moral transformation and actually to be changed, you know, and ultimately to be made perfect, right? None of us is there yet. But, and this is a big emphasis in Lewis, you know, God's not going to stop working on us until every last vestige of sin is removed and we are entirely conformed to the image of Christ. So I think you see a strong virtue emphasis there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't think if someone comes along and says, well, there you have it, you know, Lewis is a virtue theorist and that's it. You know, I don't think that really, covers the field. I mean, he does talk about the importance of obeying God's commands, but he's not really a traditional divine command theorist. And then again, I think if we were to ask him, if God commands us to do something, do we have an obligation to do it? I think he would, without hesitation, say yes. Yeah. I do think that he would probably then say, though, well, but of course, God's commands somehow issue from his character, right, and that right. kind of thing. But then again, most traditional divine command theorists say something very similar. Robert Adams certainly does.
You guys do it in good God, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, you're right. You have this really impressive array, divine command theory, divine motivation theory, divine desire theory, divine preference theory, divine will theory. Yeah, and you could give names associated right. with each one of these. I think it's a really fun literature to read, and I'm not going to pretend to be able to adjudicate that at the moment. I would say, though, that I think it's very interesting that you've got all of these guys, Phil Quinn, Robert Adams, Matt Jordan, Christian Miller, Linda Zagzebski, and others, who are giving these various accounts, right? But what they would all agree on is that morality is rooted in God, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately in his character, and then maybe secondarily in his commands, or in his will, or in his desires, or preference, or whatever. What they agree on, in a sense, is more important than what they disagree on, it seems to me. They all see the primacy of God in ethics. And so I think that's a very hopeful and encouraging sign for the moral apologist, mm-hmm. who isn't necessarily a wedded to one of these. Or maybe he is, but it's not that moral apologetics. To be a moral apologist, you have to be a divine command theorist or a divine motivation theorist or something like that. You just have to see that somehow or other God functions at the foundation of morality. And then, of course, natural law is a very rich tradition, and arguably Lewis was more in that tradition than any other, it seems to me. So
what does that mean to be a theistic natural law person?
Well, I think it seems to be the idea that having been made in God's image, we have a particular nature, and that nature finds its deepest fulfillment in relationship with God and in relationship with others as God intended us to live. So there is a teleological structure to the way in which we have been made, right? There is a goal in mind. We were made to achieve that goal, to experience intimacy with God and intimacy with others, and to have the sort of desires God wants us to have that will be satisfied. And the way this works out in Lewis is rather interesting. I mean, you really could argue that there's a sense in which Lewis was something of a hedonist. Mm-hmm. Piper certainly makes this case where Lewis is concerned, and I don't entirely agree with all of what he has to say on this. But a very real and important part of Lewis's moral system here is that we were made for joy. We were made to experience deep satisfaction and fulfillment and pleasure. And ultimately, what makes us most fulfilled, what conduces to our deepest joy, is nothing less than intimacy with God himself. And of course, there are numerous times where Lewis says or intimates that God is the good. Like you right. began with that question, right? And I know some people have a concern about this, right? Are we reifying goodness, like acting like there's such a thing as goodness, when really they're only good things or instances of good things? But that's kind of the point. If goodness, let's suppose, has to be instantiated so that it exists insofar as there is a good book or a good college or a good person or something like that, this only bolsters the need to give an account of what would ultimately constitute goodness. It has to be instantiated after all, right?
What is being instantiated?
Yeah. And so if God is the ultimate good, if God is the one who is wholly good, the God in whom there's no shadow of turning, right, no vestige of darkness, no corruption, no sinfulness or anything like that, right, then to say of him that he is the ultimate good is to say that, look, the ultimate good is instantiated. Mm-hmm. It's concretely found in God. Mm-hmm. This, by the way, I think is very much related to why William Lane Craig rejects the existence of certain universals. Because he says, like, with respect to God, you know, the good is, you know, God himself, in the sense that God is the ultimate instantiation of this kind of thing. It's something concrete, not abstract,
right?
You know, yeah. I kind of like that. Anyway, Lewis's insight, I think, and I could be wrong, but I mean, this is my best guess, and I think this is very Adamsian too. What is best for us is that we are in a dynamic, vital relationship with what is intrinsically good, mm-hmm. right? So it's not just an instrumental matter of, you know, what happens to be good for us or what happens to, you know, give us a sense of fulfillment, right? That which objectively gives us our deepest joy and sense of fulfillment is commerce with, right, interaction with, relationship with, what is ultimately good in and of itself, most purely, most truly, most ultimately, and that is God himself. Because so Lewis was very clear, you know, God himself is the ultimate good. So what is best for us is to be in relationship with him. And then secondarily, but intimately tied with that, is to be in loving relationship with our neighbor. So there you have it.
Yeah, so this is the kind of view that's undergirding Lewis's moral argument, that, you know, the connection of humans to this good and God as the best. I mean, if once you flesh out what goodness is, it's hard to see any kind of naturalistic explanation that would come close to providing the kind of explanatory framework that we have with theism.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, Lewis didn't have kind of a deflationary or emaciated understanding of what goodness is. It was a very rich and robust understanding. This, of course, is why some naturalists would balk, because they would say, look, I'm not trying to explain goodness in anything like that kind of way,
right.
You know? I'm much more content with just talking about goodness in more garden variety ways, you know, like social harmony or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do that. And I think that you're not without insight in doing that. In fact, this is one of the reasons, again, why I think the abductive approach is the way to go. Because it's not the case that our naturalist friends, when they do this, are saying something utterly ridiculous. I think they're watering down the concept of goodness in this mm-hmm. case, maybe a little bit or maybe a lot. But what they're saying, you know, is true as far as it goes.
Yeah.
And I think that they can get down that road of moral explanation, at least to some extent. But I just happen to think that when you conjoin the resources they're appealing to in the world with the resources found in God himself, who is the creator of the world and ever so much greater than merely the world, you can get a considerably better understanding of what morality is all about and a better explanation for why these things would have validity.
Yeah, so let's kind of sum this up here. The situation that we're looking at with Lewis's moral argument, or maybe kind of casting it in light of what we just said, is we have this reality, or this robust notion of goodness that we implicitly recognize, yes, with our language,
mm-hmm.
right? When we talk about, we implicitly recognize it with our language, but we also fall short of this standard there is this robust goodness, we fall short of it, and then we can ask the question, well, what is the best explanation of this being the case? That we have this incredible standard of goodness, and we fall short of it. And then, of course, C.S. Lewis is going to suggest that, well, that God exists, but God exists, and that he establishes this moral standard. Is that right? Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yeah. There's a sense in which perhaps he embodies the standard, as he's the ultimate good. But goodness here, in one way or another, issues in obligations for us to perform in certain ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
To live up to this standard. And the obligations we're under have a kind of prescriptive power. They have a kind of authority, right? And it's notoriously hard on naturalism to explain where that sort of moral authority would come from. But the recognition of the authority is something that we all have, right? I think Lewis would say that when we're all honest with ourselves, we just know that some things are right and some things are wrong, and that there's an authoritative force to morality. So he sort of goes in quest of what the source of the moral authority is, and he, for the life of him, just can't seem to locate the source of moral authority in the natural world alone. He thinks that this is a piece of evidence that when we carefully examine it, points us beyond the world, beyond the physical realm. And it's an echo, it's an intimation of something supernatural. And this is why he thought that a moral argument could function very effectively as evidence for God's existence.
Well, thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I certainly learned a lot myself from Dr. Baggett on C.S. Lewis's moral argument. I want to direct your attention to the Moral Apologetics website, where we have the new Twilight Musing series from Elton D. Higgs. Dr. Higgs is a mentor of Dr. Baggett's for many years now, and Dr. Higgs also wrote our leaked document series, which I encourage you to check out too. But make sure you visit the site on a frequent basis. We update it 2 or 3 times a week with new content from a wide array of different authors. So check up there. And thank you for stopping by, and hopefully we'll see you back here again in 2 weeks for another MoralApologetics.com podcast.